final case for argument this morning is in the matter of the estate of Ronald Dean Trotman. For the appellant, Nancy Jean Trotman, is Kenneth Duell, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellees, Mr. Thomas Simmons, an attorney also from Rapid City. Mr. Duell, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Simmons. Before I start, I'm going to take a minute of my time and use personal privilege to point out that in my 29 years of practice, this is the first time that my father has appeared here to hear me argue. And when I asked him, I said, is this the first time you've heard me argue? He says, only with the Supreme Court, because he and I argue all the time. So the biggest judge that I have is in the room in the back after 50 years of practice.
So is he hoping you win this one as opposed to the ones with him?
We're about half and half there, and I didn't ask him about this one. Anyway, the case that brings us today before you involves the issuance or the surrounds a supplemental or a voluntary life term policy that Ron Trotman had acquired from his employer, Rapid City Regional Hospital. So it is clear in the brief, Mr. Trotman had a basic life policy that the hospital provided to him, a $50,000 policy. And then he was able to acquire a voluntary life term policy, and that's the policy that we're here about today. The basic life policy, there's no question that Mr. Trotman intended that policy by a specific change of beneficiary form in 1997 to go to his three children by his first wife, the appellees here, the three boys. But this case becomes important in that after he did that, he married Nancy Smith Trotman, his second wife. And after that, he made a decision through the voluntary life term, the VTL policy, to make an application for more insurance because, as Nancy testified, Ron brought a lot of debt to this marriage and they needed to get things cleared up. And so one of the ways they're going to do that in the event of his untimely death was to buy more insurance. So Ron made that application with Transamerica, disclosed his health condition, and then made the application. And in that application, it said beneficiary, 100,000, Chad, Jeff, and Brad, sons, and 100,000 to Nancy. Well, that policy was ultimately denied based on his health provisions. But if you look at the exhibit, I think it's exhibit number 4, the company never said, by the way, we reject your change of beneficiary to the voluntary life policy, or we don't understand the change of beneficiary to the voluntary.
Wouldn't it remain the same, though, until they affirmatively say, we acknowledge the change that's been made?
That's why we're here, because that did not happen. After his death, the administrator's office, Sherry Williams, issued that fax, which I call the Transamerica fax, that said the policy increase was denied, but under the policy, it appears to us that it should be 50-50. In other words, 50,000 to the boys and 50,000 to Nancy. But more importantly, before we even get to that issue, is the underlying issue is that after that denial had occurred with the increase, Ron and Nancy went over to Wells Fargo and refinanced their home, got a second mortgage, and used this policy, this $100,000 policy, as additional collateral to secure that mortgage in the event of Ron's untimely death, because as Nancy testified, Ron carried 70% of the income and it was his debt. Well, Ron died. We got into dispute over this $100,000 policy. Those funds were not available to pay Wells Fargo, so Nancy used her own funds to pay off that second mortgage, $37,000 and change. And so first we have to look and see whether or not Ron and Nancy intended that policy to be used, regardless of who the beneficiary was, to satisfy that mortgage. And I think the evidence is clear that that was the intent of those documents with Wells Fargo, Exhibits 5, 6, and 7, and also Ron's intent that he wanted his wife to be taken care of. He didn't want her straddled with this debt. And that in the event of his untimely death, because he was a well-paid chief financial officer at the hospital, He had a large salary, and if that was gone, she would not have the ability to pay for the real estate mortgage.
I didn't understand the setup on the life insurance. Was it, there was a part of it that he could assign to pay his debts?
He could have assigned it all.
Okay.
He could have taken the basic policy and said, I want to use that, or I want to use a voluntary and use that. He chose not to. He left the basic life policy, the BLT policy, to the boys, the $50,000. But on the $100,000 voluntary life, the 2010, if you look at the numbers, if you're one of those people, he said, that's the policy Nancy and I want to use to secure our mortgage. So in the event of my untimely death, we can collateralize that to the bank. Well, that didn't happen because we got in this dispute. So
how
Nancy,
did the trial court handle that intent issue?
Well, the trial court said, well, there was no default because Nancy paid it off with her own funds. So she's not entitled to reimbursement from that. And in essence, that this court shouldn't look at that either because there was no default. The intent's unclear. Well, the intent's very clear. Anytime anyone goes out to a bank and says, I'm collateralizing it with my house and I'm collateralizing with a life insurance policy, it means if I die, my widow doesn't have to be strapped with that debt. And that's what Ron did. Yet the trial court said, that's speculation. There was no default. She paid it off. She's not entitled to those funds.
Did he assign the policy to the bank?
He did.
So the bank came into a position ahead of the three boys, even if it belongs to them.
That's our argument. Another complication that brings us to the Supreme Court is we cannot determine from Wells Fargo, Northwest, now Wells Fargo, it appears as they may not have sent that assignment in, but there is an assignment in the file.
But I don't see.
Did they hold the policy? Excuse me.
No, they did not hold the policy because it's a group policy through the hospital. It's a group life policy.
And I don't see any determination by the trial court of the relative priorities to the proceeds of the policy.
He said that our position that Nancy should be reimbursed for that because she had to use her own funds, he said there was no default. Therefore, there's no right to those benefits.
But in theory, who had first right to those proceeds?
In theory, I believe under South Dakota law, contract law, you go first to the assignment that he and Nancy made to pay off the mortgage. Because he controlled that. It was his policy. He was the owner. He had the right to designate the beneficiaries. He had the right to assign those to his insurance carrier or to his bank to do that.
Now, the other thing is, though, I mean, is this really even a relevant issue? I mean, isn't the first issue we need to address, you know, whether or not this change of beneficiary was effective or not? I mean,
no, I think first you've got to look to see what did Ron do with the policy. He assigned it to Wells Fargo as collateral. Then, assuming there are funds left, and in this case there are, because it's our position that $37,400 should be returned to Nancy since it wasn't available because we're fighting over it, and to save her good name, she paid that. She didn't have to do that. She could have allowed it to go into default and her credit would have been hurt, but she paid it.
But because it's collateral, the bank is only entitled to whatever legally, you know,
to the extent of the loan.
To the extent of the policy, including beneficiaries and whatever else govern the terms of the policy.
That's not the law in South Dakota, with all due respect, Your Honor. We all have life insurance. We assign it to our banks with the intention that when Ron dies, the first thing that goes is you pay off your mortgage because that was collateral. And if there are beneficiaries and money left over, then you look to that, and that's who gets the residual funds. The trial court said, no, there was no default.
And since the beneficiaries are still the same, unless you get back to the issue one, the beneficiaries are still the three sons on that. And so the fact of assignment is really immaterial, isn't it?
Well, it's material only when you get done with the bank applying the collateral to satisfy the loan. Nancy's entitled to this court requiring the trial court or an order from this court directing that those funds should first have been used as Ron intended them as collateral for that note. And then if there's any residual, then we get down to who are the beneficiaries under the residuals in the policy, and that's the other principal issue here. That's the bigger funds.
Did Nancy and the boys sign the assignment?
No, they don't have to. The policy's owned by Ron. Nancy did sign the assignment as his spouse when they did the refinancing because it was a combined note, collateral, assignment of the policy. Ron signed the assignment, that particular document. She signed the other two that identified the voluntary life term policy as being collateral for that loan.
Isn't she in that position a volunteer where she just she voluntarily pays it off? And she could have brought an issue including the three sons and the insurance company to see whether or not your theory is correct, right?
Well, what happened is while we were trying to dialogue with this after the Transamerica facts came out, Transamerica, and I think Mr. Simmons will acknowledge this, threatened to file a declaratory judgment in New Jersey. And we said, no, don't do that. Put the funds in somebody's trust account in Rapid City and get out of our way. And that's ultimately what they did. But while that dialogue's going on, Nancy's got payments she's made, the house sold because she had a right to make that decision, and she had to use funds she would not have otherwise had to use to pay off that mortgage because those insurance funds were not available to her. So I think, first of all, this court has a duty to say that the assignment by Ron to pay off the mortgage was valid. It was the proceeds were duty-bound to require that those go there, and since Nancy was exposed to that, if you will, she was a volunteer in that sense, she's still entitled to be reimbursed because but for this lawsuit and this dispute, those funds would have gone to Wells Fargo. And then we get back to the major issue on the residual funds, the $63,000. Who's the beneficiary under this policy? And it's our position that the trial court ignored the law. South Dakota, the trial court posed a strict compliance with the contract in order for that to occur. That's not the law in South Dakota. Semler specifically says that we have substantial compliance as our rule. If the insured and the insurer agree that substantial compliance has occurred, then we're going to do in equity what equity would do, and that is honor the terms of that contract. But the trial court said, I beg to differ with the insurance company. Those are his words. I beg to differ with the insurance company. It's clear that Ron intended that policy. And I'm just going to talk about the voluntary life policy, the $100,000 policy, because basic life is gone. The policy, he wanted it split 50-50. Could he have used better terms? Absolutely. Could he have gone and gotten a change of beneficiary form? Absolutely. We probably wouldn't be here. But that's not the law. The law is, did he substantially comply with the provisions that require written, sufficient written notice to us on page 3 of the contract, Exhibit 1, so that we are on notice and we recorded in our administrator's office that that's what you want to do. When they didn't.
I'm not persuaded at this point that he's half as clear on his intent as you indicate. He's never, ever stated what his intent was once he finds out that they're not going to, his intent was, as I see it, to split it if he got $200,000 in insurance. But if he only has $100,000 in insurance, I've never seen where his intent is clear that he wanted that to be split between his children and his new wife.
I think the evidence does show that, Your Honor. The evidence shows that after the denial of the increase came back, it did not say, we don't understand your change of beneficiary, we're not honoring it, please complete a form. Nothing was said. But what did...
Well, can't he write and say, well, did you change the beneficiary the way I wanted it, if I wanted it that way anyway?
In a perfect world, he should have done that. But what he did do is he told not only his wife, who is a witness, but he also told his attorney, Ms. Viken, I've split my policy half to the boys and half to my wife.
Well,
and there's only one policy to which that could apply.
But
and
if
that's
if
this policy.
If this case were to turn on what he said to Ms. Viken and to his wife, we'd be adopting the Minnesota rule.
I don't think you have to go that far, Judge.
Well, if you if this is effective merely by telling some third party that that's what you intended, that's essentially a rule way beyond what South Dakota's ever permitted.
That Minnesota rule, as we all know, was he wrote a letter to his daughter saying, I'm changing my policy. That's not what Ron Troutman did here. He wrote to his own company and said, 1,000, 1,000. He then turned around and said, I mean a 50-50 split. That's what he told his lawyer. That's what he told Ms. Viken.
That's what his new wife says he told the lawyer. Did Ms. Viken testify?
She didn't, because that's undisputed testimony. Mr. Simmons, the boys could have called Ms. Viken and said, is that true? They did not.
Well,
and the trial court doesn't.
Did the trial court have a little bit of question as to what sometimes husbands might say to a second wife as to money matters?
Certainly. But this case is all by depositions and documents. So you have the right to make that decision yourself under your own rules if that's what you want to find. But that the trial court didn't even do that. The trial court didn't even talk about that. It just says we're not going to use substantial compliance. We're not going to use an equitable exception. It just said he didn't file a change of beneficiary form. Period. End of case. I beg to differ with the insurance company. And so that's the problem, is he never allowed us to look at, or he never looked at, the issue of substantial compliance.
Okay. State what you think constitutes substantial compliance.
The insured did what he thought he had to do in order to put his insurance company on notice that he wanted to make a change, and the company then acknowledges that that change is going to occur. They did that by that Transamerica fax. The administrator said, we rejected the increase, but by our interpretation as the administrator, we believe it's a 50-50. 50,000 to the boys, 50,000 to Nancy.
Now, that fax came in after he died, right?
It did.
Is that significant, that it's after the fact instead of contemporaneous with the request for the change?
I don't believe it is, because nobody knew this was going to happen. First of all, nobody knew Ron was going to die. But secondly, nobody knew this was going to be an issue, because Ron thought it was a done deal.
Was it recorded on the policy?
Recorded on the policy?
Yeah.
All we have is a Transamerica fax. These people became impossible to deal with after that. They tendered the money and said, we believe it's a 50-50. Send in the forms. We did. Mr. Simmons' client said, no, we're not signing off. We think it's ours. So we ultimately got him to tender the money. But that was their interpretation. The administrator's office, Ms. Williams is in the administrator's office, says that's the way we believe the policy was intended to be divided. That's substantial compliance. As I said earlier, he should have done more. He could have done more. But that's not our rule. The rule is, did he do enough to put the insurance company on notice? And that leads us ultimately to the question, well, why do we have that rule? We have that rule so insurance companies don't get sued by multiple parties. They're not involved in litigation. They pay mom the money and the boys say, wait a minute, it's ours. That's not the case here. We took that out by agreeing that we would fight amongst ourselves, if you will, over those proceeds because they're in a trust account. And because the insurance companies not at risk, there are not multiple claims that they're exposed to. And so a more liberal interpretation of Ron's intent should be used. And it's clear from this record that Ron intended that. He gave his boys a retirement account. He gave Nancy a retirement account. He gave the boys a basic life. He gave her a house with a huge debt. But he intended the policy to be split 50-50. The boys would have money. His wife would have money to pay off the house. That did not happen. And it's our belief that the trial court erred in that decision as a matter of law, and that you should reverse that decision. And I have the recommended distribution in the conclusion of both of my briefs that says reimburse Nancy the first amount that should have been paid and then split the balance 50-50. And in doing that, remember that Nancy has already agreed the money we're not fighting over has already been released to the boys. It's only the part that's in dispute that's still being held. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Duell. Mr. Simmons, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. My name's Tom Simmons, and I represent Brad, Chad, and Jeff Troutman, the three surviving adult sons of Ronald Dean Troutman, who died at the relatively young age of 57 in May of 2003. Mr. Duell recited the facts very briefly. Those facts are that originally this policy had Ronald Dean Troutman's former wife as the sole beneficiary. Ronald Dean Troutman then filled out a change of beneficiary form, changing the beneficiaries to his three sons following his divorce from his first spouse. That change was acknowledged by the insurance company in a writing to the insured saying that we have made that change and it's recorded in our offices. Later, in 1999, he applied for additional coverage. On the application for additional coverage, which is not a change of beneficiary form, he wrote $100,000 Brad, Jeff, and Chad, $100,000 Nancy J. wife. That was specifically rejected in writing by the insurance company. It was never confirmed whether it was recorded. In May of 2003, then Ronald Troutman died. The two cases which talk about substantial compliance from this court are Stemler and Sheffield. They're cited in both of our briefs. Those cases articulate what that doctrine is and how it applies to specific facts. In both of those cases, a modern Woodman policy was at issue, and the terms of the contract were substantially the same. They had a fairly detailed requirement by which beneficiaries could be changed that required a notarized statement, a surrender on the back of the actual certificate delivered to the local person who would forward it to the corporate person up the line. In both cases, the insured filed the form appropriately, notarized, delivered, and surrendered to the local officer, who then delivered it up the chain of command and died 2 days later in both cases. In both cases, this court said that's not substantial compliance, despite the fact that the provisions of the contract were, to a very large extent, followed by the insured, reasoning that in the first case, it wasn't delivered in time. The insurance company didn't get the form before he died. They didn't know he had died when they got the form, and they recorded the change.
In those cases, did the insurance company take the position that there had been a successful change in beneficiary?
In both cases, it's very similar to here, Chief Justice, in that the insurance company really didn't want to be particularly involved or take a position one way or the other.
Well, I'm troubled here by the trial court's reference. I disagree respectfully with the insurance company. If an insurance policy is a private contract between an insurance company and a person who purchases a policy, is it appropriate for the trial court to interject its views if the two contracting parties think a change has been made? And obviously that hinges on the facts that your opponents referred to.
Here's what evidence was presented in the form of any statements from the insurance company. It was a copy of a fax from an individual at that company. I don't know what her job duties are, what background she has. She's apparently in underwriting.
Did you challenge that in the lower court?
Yes, yes. We objected, and
What did you present?
There's no foundation to it whatsoever, and it's hearsay as well.
It did come in, however, didn't it?
Pardon me?
It did come in, however.
It did. The court overruled all objections and considered that piece of evidence, but focused on, I think, one, that it probably wasn't deserving of a whole lot of weight because we don't know how it was generated, and two, that the insurance company never stated that the change was recorded. That's what's required by the policy, that the change in beneficiaries be recorded. And that statement, the Transamerica fact, does not say that. In fact, the evidence suggests very, very strongly that no such change was ever recorded because the first time a change was made, it was recorded and confirmed to the insured. The second time he made an application for additional benefits, they did no such confirmation. Instead, they specifically rejected his application. The second issue that's presented, and it's not specifically set forth as a separate issue within the appellant's brief, but as I try to articulate what that issue is, there are five cases that the appellants cite. Livingston, Henry Cohen's estate, Froham, Fidelity, and Lamport's estate from different jurisdictions, the newest being 1975. None of those cases recognize or really even consider recognizing whether a co-borrower like Nancy Troutman has any right to assert the secured rights of her lender to deplete a beneficiary's right to life insurance proceeds. It does not appear in any of the cases that have been cited that that is a cause of action that's ever been recognized or even been considered to be recognized. And what Judge Fuller focused on here was that those are rights of Wells Fargo, formerly known as Norwest, the lender. They're not rights that the co-borrower can assert vis-a-vis her lender. There was no default that was triggered. There was no foreclosure that was commenced. And even if that had happened, we don't know how the funds would have shaken out because Wells Fargo could have proceeded against the home or the life insurance policy. They could have pursued the home entirely and satisfied their rights out of the home. And I don't know then if Nancy could have asserted any rights against Wells Fargo for wrongfully pursuing different collateral when it had the rights to do so. There does not appear to be any cause of action like that that's ever been recognized. And at any rate, Wells Fargo isn't a party to these proceedings.
So so the alternative would be, if your argument is not persuasive as far as the substantial compliance, would just be to split it 50-50?
Well, I don't know, Justice Meyer-Henry, because I don't know what her damages in her second issue actually would have been. I don't know what the ultimate cost of that foreclosure would have been with attorney's fees and costs that could have been assessed against her. And there are cases which recognize a beneficiary's right to claim subrogation in this kind of an instance, where my clients could claim, even when the policy had been depleted by virtue of the assignment, subrogation right against Nancy Troutman. So then that would also be an additional credit. And we just get into level after level of speculation upon what the actual amount would be, assuming that she can even assert those rights.
You know, under the substantial compliance, the way I understand it, I mean, one of the basis that one of the reasons that this court has adopted that doctrine is to attempt to get at the intent of the person that has the insured. But you know, did the trial court really address intent in this case? It seemed to me that the trial court may have applied a stricter standard and really didn't think about whether or not it's intent. I don't see a lot in the findings that deal with his intent.
Certainly all of the intent evidence was presented to the trial court, whether they actually made specific findings on that. The appellant cites Stemler for their proposition that intent is a relevant inquiry in the substantial compliance doctrine. That's not what Stemler says. Stemler doesn't examine intent. It examines whether the policy language itself was substantially complied with. And as far as intent goes, the only really objective witness that was presented that didn't have a specific financial interest in this matter was that of the decedent's sister, Sharon Frank. And she said that very shortly before the decedent passed away, after the application for additional insurance would have been declined, he told her, the decedent told his sister, that he had, in fact, designated his boys as beneficiaries on that policy.
But the trial court never addressed that either, one
no.
way or the other.
No, it didn't. It's evidence in our favor insofar as intent is relevant, but the court did
I
not
guess
rely
my
on
concern
that.
is the absence of any discussion of intent by this trial court.
I don't believe it's actually relevant unless you determine that the contract for insurance itself is ambiguous and the appellants have not pointed to any specific provision within the policy that they feel is ambiguous. They have not pointed to any particular term, like in the case that was argued before us this morning, where a specific term is alleged to be ambiguous and susceptible to more than one meaning. In the Sheffield case, by way of example, here is what the insured did, which was found not to substantially comply with the terms of the contract. He executed a change of beneficiary on the reverse side of the certificate of insurance as required by the policy and in the form prescribed. And he wrote, "I, James A. Gillette, the neighbor to whom this benefit certificate was issued, do hereby surrender and request the cancellation of this benefit certificate and order that a new one shall be issued in the amount of $3,000 and shall be payable to Florence Sheffield or Clara Louise Sheffield, who is related to me as my sister and niece." Modern Woodman wrote back to him and said, we really need to know whether Clara is related to you by blood, because that's a provision in our bylaws that we require beneficiaries to be related by blood. And we don't see that. In the meanwhile, he had died. Now, Clara, the contingent beneficiary anyway, had already passed away. And the insurer didn't know that. And this court still found that the insurance company has a right to have their provisions for changing a beneficiary adhered to. And it gave an example in the Stemler case where substantial appliance compliance would apply. It's in the circumstance where the insured has done everything within his or her power to comply with the way in which a beneficiary change is made, but can't for some reason. For example, when the original certificate of insurance is lost or is being held by another individual and the insured can't get to it. There's physically no way that the insured can strictly comply with the terms of changing beneficiaries. That's the example that was given by this court where substantial compliance would apply. This court determined that James A. Gillette's change of beneficiary designations, as clear as that appears to me, to be ambiguous. Here we have an even more ambiguous change in that it's not on a change of beneficiary form, and it doesn't say 50-50, it says 100,000, 100,000. I think even if you're going to try to give effect to the intent of the insured as written on that application for additional benefits, you can legitimately conclude that he wanted $100,000 to go to Nancy only if he got $100,000 in additional coverage. That's not what happened.
So the ambiguity is to what his directions were? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, because to carry out his intent here, we have to speculate about what he really did intend. It's not clear on the basis of the application for additional benefits that's being presented as affecting a change of beneficiaries. In closing, if there are no additional questions, this court has explained...
I have one.
Yes, Judge Sinzer.
How would you respond to Mr. Duell's suggestion, if I heard it correctly, that the assignment to the bank issue really is... Mr. Duell says that's the first thing we have to deal with, if I heard him correctly, and that kind of controls the case. How do you respond to that?
I think the court needs to reach both issues. I don't know if the sequence of them really ultimately makes any difference. I think they're two independent legal theories that have been presented by the appellants. And theoretically, you could find for one and not the other, or for both, as appellant is urging. This wasn't a credit life insurance type of a policy where the type of policy that you can obtain in connection with obtaining a mortgage where the proceeds will automatically go towards satisfaction of the mortgage. That's not the kind of policy that this was. And Wells Fargo was not named a beneficiary. It says specifically on the assignment forms that the beneficiary shall remain unchanged.
Well, then is the record adequate for us to establish priority to these proceeds?
Well,
I mean, since it's not a credit life type policy.
I don't think priority ever actually becomes implicated because Wells Fargo's rights are never asserted by Wells Fargo, and they're never matured to the extent where the lender can assert those rights. It doesn't declare a default. It doesn't declare a default. And so those proceeds never become subject to the secured rights of Wells Fargo. My understanding, and I don't know, frankly, if this is clear in the record, but the reason that policy was pledged was not to relieve the burden on a surviving spouse, but because the amount of the mortgage exceeded the value of the home, the equity that was available, and the lender was going to require additional security. It wasn't a testamentary intent. It was a lending requirement. In Sheffield, this court said that the contract for insurance ought to be honored as it makes certain who the beneficiaries are and prevents complications and difficulties arising in determining the rights of the conflicting claimants. That's the rationale underlying this court's articulation of what it will require to see a beneficiary change effected. Judge Fuller was right on the facts, he was right on the law, and we urge that his judgment be affirmed.
One question. Was the value of the home Did the value of the home exceed the mortgage at the time of his death?
I don't believe so. She received some proceeds at closing, and I believe that's within her affidavit.
At closing of what?
Well, she sold the house.
Okay.
All right. And she got money back.
So thank you.
So the value of the home did exceed the mortgage?
It did, I believe, because it was a relatively short-term loan, and it was being paid down rather aggressively.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons. Mr. Dooley, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you.
Before you start, I want to ask a question. I haven't looked at the pleadings, and this was a declaratory judgment.
Yes.
How did the bank's priority come in your request for relief?
In our amended answer, we asserted that Nancy, because she had by this time sold the house, had to do something with that. She used $37,000 of her own funds, and that's laid out in the answer and her supplemental affidavit. We then, in our amended answer, before discovery was completed, asserted that that those proceeds should first have been used, were not, and she should be reimbursed for them.
So was it an unjust enrichment, or what kind of a theory did you have when you pled it?
That the contract that Ron had with the bank should have been honored, and that those proceeds should have gone to pay that.
Would the bank have had to have started a foreclosure in order to get those funds from the insurance?
No, no. The problem with the bank in this case is apparently the bank officer, she says she faxed it off to him, but there's no proof that she ever did. I mean, there's no fax cover sheet that says at the top we sent it here and it was received okay. But it's clear that the assignment of the proceeds is in the bank file, the note identifies it as collateral. The security agreement identifies it as collateral.
With the bank, I haven't looked at the assignment, but does the assignment say there has to be a default?
No, they're entitled to the proceeds. If in the event of an untimely death during the time the loan is in existence.
Is there any bank document that regulates the order in which the bank must resort to the different items of collateral that secured the loan?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, if that's the case, then we're back to where we started. How do we know which piece of collateral the bank, how can the bank be required to proceed against?
That's not the issue, with all due respect. The issue is, did Ron intend the life insurance proceeds to be used to pay off the loan if he died? The answer is yes.
Well, no matter what he intended, you have to have some legal cause of action to recover. You want reimbursement, as
We sought reimbursement in our amended answer because the funds got tied up and Nancy could no longer wait to pay off because she sold the house and it was going to be her credit, her good credit, that was at jeopardy. So she made the payment.
So if the bank isn't required to proceed against the insurance policy first, walk me through your legal theory of how she's entitled to reimbursement. What's the cause of action and why is the bank obligated to use those funds first?
The bank's not obligated. The insurance policy's obligated to be applied to pay the note. It did not happen. Those cases, if I may, the cases I cited to you, Cohen and in Lamport and all those from other jurisdictions say the borrower has the right to dictate what to do with those proceeds. He did. He said, pay off my note. Then what's left, the residuals, go to the beneficiaries designated in the policy, which is a separate issue here.
Did those cases involve over-security like it appears we have here?
I can't candidly stand here and tell you. I don't remember. A couple of them had various notes, were notes in motion, but I can't tell you if they were over-collateralized or not in that respect.
I have a little bit of problem that I'm not sure that solves your problem. If Ron or the bank would have checked with the insurance company at that date, from my understanding of the record, there's no showing that the beneficiaries on that $100,000 policy were anything other than the three brothers. So you come down to the fact that unless there's substantial compliance to change the beneficiary, where does it get her?
in the first instance, it gets her the mortgage paid off. It gets her the $37,000. It doesn't matter who the beneficiaries all are at first, because he assigned the policy to pay the bank loan. It was not used for that purpose. So Nancy had to pay it.
Well, he's the owner of the policy.
Right, and he could assign
it. He signs it to pay off his own mortgage.
Right.
Okay. And the beneficiaries, say, are the three sons. Okay.
If that's what they would have told him. I'm not convinced that's what they would have told him, but in your scenario, it doesn't matter who the beneficiaries are. It could be the neighbor. The policy first needs to go to pay the Wells Fargo loan. It was not. So Nancy had to pay it.
But you, in answer to Justice Zinner's question, you acknowledge that the bank had no obligation to follow either way on the proceeds.
It's not the bank. It's the insurance company. It's Ron turning to Transamerica and saying, when I die, I've told the bank I want this as collateral on this loan. I want it to pay this off. I think it also goes to his intent with the beneficiary issue, because if he didn't intend that, why did he use this policy? If it was to only go to his boys and be $100,000 to his boys, why did he use that policy?
Maybe it's the only collateral he has. He's the owner of the policy. It's maybe the only collateral he has.
He had other policies. He had other retirement accounts. He left those, one to Nancy, one to the boys. He left the boys a basic life policy for $50,000. His intent was pay off the mortgage and split this $100,000 policy with my children, wife and children, split it that way. And they were paying that down so that ultimately that would occur, so that it would stay in balance. That was his intent. But the trial court never looked at any of that. The trial court said specifically, I beg to differ with the insurance company. Those are his words, not mine. He didn't look at substantial compliance or equitable exception to strict compliance. He just said he didn't sign a change of beneficiary form, end of the case. That's wrong. That's not the law. The law is under Semler and Sheffield and the other cases I cited to you that you have to look to the intent of the contract between the contracting parties. What did Ron intend to do? What did the insurance company intend to do? Ron intended ambiguously to do something. That's why you have to look and go to his intent. It's clear from the evidence presented on intent that he wanted to split that policy between his second wife and his adult children. And if you look at the sister's testimony, with all due respect to her and sisters everywhere, she doesn't say, Ron told me the voluntary term life policy is going to be going on the boys. She said, he's taking care of the boys. He's got property for the boys. Well, he did. She was not aware that they were getting a retirement account, or that they got the basic life policy. There's no specific reference in her testimony that this particular policy is going to be split or between the three boys. But what Ron did do is he told his attorney in his attorney's office, while he's doing estate planning issues, I've taken care of the boys, I've changed my policies, half's to Nancy, half's to my boys. That's his intent. And I submit that under substantial compliance, that intent should be honored. He did everything that he was required to do, although not perfect, all that he was required to do to put the insurance company on notice that a change should occur, and they accepted that. With that, we'd ask that the decision be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dill. Court will be in recess.